Imports and box sets and empty shelf spaces.
Criterion discounts and big steelbook cases.
Amazon packages that make the doorbell ring.
These are a few of our favorite things.
What it do, Digital Booze? Pop the top on another six-pack and prepare to press play on another episode of Digital Noise right here on oneofus.net.
What the fuck did you just say?
What it do, Digital Booze?
Yeah, you heard me. That's what I do. We're here to review the things you want to buy and let you know which ones you don't actually want to buy.
I think there was a line on Parappa the Rapper.
I think it was an Usher song.
Indeed it was. I'm your host, Brian. Your mother and I are very disappointed, Salisbury. And I'm joined in this digital union with my cohorts, Christopher St. Lawrence of the Clan Cox.
Haha, Cox.
Oh, do I say something now?
Yes.
Something!
All right, good contribution. And Luke Firebeard Mullen.
At some point, I'm going to have to be known for something other than my beard.
Luke, full of information about a lot of different things, Mullen. And we also respect him for his mind, Mullen.
Sure.
Hey, which isn't to say anything bad about his body. I mean, let's face it, the guy is hot.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask, did any of you see Six Souls?
God damn it. Not again.
It's been a week, for God's sakes. Are you still holding on to that?
Maybe.
Maybe he's going to do one for each week, so it'll be 6 weeks before he stops mentioning it. But before we get too derailed by our own foolishness, it's time to get you, the listener, involved by taking a little glimpse into
the letter box.
You've got mail.
God, I love that. So our first question in the letter box comes from Seth Moore, who asks, "What are your thoughts on Sharknado?" Seth, I am so glad you asked about this. Sharknado was the latest movie effort, and I say effort because it wasn't really a movie, from the Sci-Fi Channel, who tends to do these sort of weird animal mashup films.
Sharks like, and whatever.
Sharks and what? Sharktopus, or Two-Headed Shark, or Shark versus Piranha. They just like to, like, I mean, they do this a lot where they just take one animal, mash it up with another, usually a shark is involved. They've apparently run out of animals to mash up with sharks, so now they're just mashing up sharks with natural disasters.
Weather phenomenon.
Yes.
I'm waiting for Sharkquake.
Sharkquake is going to be amazing.
Yeah. First of all, no, the sequel is going to be called Earthquack, and it's going to be giant ducks from the center of the earth that are released, and it's ducks out of nowhere.
But maybe they have shark heads. Can we
do it? Shark heads.
Because is it a fissure in the middle of the Pacific Ocean?
Yes, it is.
Shark is like the ultimate branding. You put shark in any title and people will see it.
Shark Week.
Shark Week, exactly.
So my thoughts on Sharknado. I did actually tune in.
Did you see the whole thing, Brian?
I did not. I came in late, which means...
Sad.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately it means I can't do a full review unless I'm writing for the New York Observer. I will say...
Not a Rex Reed joke.
Boom! Fuck you, Rex Reed.
Damn.
But no, I mean, I like the fact, like, don't get me wrong, the Sci-Fi Channel movies are shit. They are absolute garbage. However, there comes a point where you have to tune in and see how they're going to pull off something as ridiculous and over the top as a tornado that throws sharks at people.
I think the big question on everyone's mind is it entertaining garbage?
It actually is. I found it to be quite entertaining, if for no other reason than they were blatantly ripping off Jaws every chance they got. And I don't know if you've seen Jaws lately.
We need a
lately.
Bigger helicopter. Like
they, yeah, they use that line. And there's also an entire USS Indianapolis speech where this girl talks about being in the water after a boat accident with her grandfather, and they're waiting to be rescued, and sharks are coming and eating people. And I'm like, and she's like, that's why I don't like sharks. I'm like, no, that's why you really like Robert Shaw. That's what that is.
I didn't get a chance to see this. I haven't had time. I definitely want to, if for no other reason than seeing the guy from 90210 cut in half a flying shark with a chainsaw.
That was amazing.
I'm sorry. That right alone in the trailer, I was like, I am going to watch this film no matter what.
We may not be able to keep a consistency as far as when it's day and when it's night in this film.
True.
But we are going to have the fucking guy from 90210 jump through a shark with a chainsaw and cut it the fuck in half.
That sounds amazing. Amazing. I'm 100% in for this film.
I'm looking forward to seeing it, although I admit it probably won't be until it actually comes out on home release.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was doing one of those things called work.
Yeah, well, this was kind of work, right? I mean, I'm talking about it now.
No, I'm just saying
this. Work, yeah. It was work-esque.
I had one of those job-type things to do at the time that this was
airing. I will say this. I wanted it to rip off not only Jaws, but Twister, to find a way to rip off both movies at the same time. Like, maybe have a character go like, you've never seen it, miss that bigger boat, and miss that bigger boat, and come after you. Like, go full completely meta-plagiarist with it.
I'm a big fan of that. I tell you what. Here's what I always look for out of these films, and it's something that I found in a South By title this year called Big Ass Spider, which people are going to make fun of, and I totally get that, but Big Ass Spider does exactly what I want these movies to do. It tries to be funny. Like, it's like it's throwing jokes at you, and it's kind of the pickle on the glass routine, like throw a bunch of pickles and see which one sticks.
Yeah.
Sticks!
Which one sticks, baby?
And Billy Madison style, you know, they'll fall to the bottom. But they got Greg Grunberg, who I actually really like, because you're always casting, like, out of the B and C pool.
Sure.
But I think Greg Grunberg is one of those strong guys who actually kind of can pull something like
off. He's one of J.J. Abrams' favorite actors.
Right. Like, I really like Greg Grunberg. He's really charismatic. He's a good choice for the lead. They keep it under 90 minutes like they should. And they just have fun with it. Like, that's all I'm looking for, is to have a good time with these movies. I don't think anybody's expecting any of them to, like, win Academy Awards. But the occasional interesting creative decision is nice. Jokes are nice. Good casting is nice. That's all I want out of these
films. And that's not to say they all get a pass, because the biggest problem with a lot of the sci-fi movie channels is that they're just fucking boring. It's not even that bad, they're just dull. Well, and Sharknado is certainly not dull.
Well, I think we talked about this a while back on our previously named show. Oh, it seems like the stuff that was coming out on Sci-Fi Channel that had that Roger Corman Productions thing, where they got that, they're like, hey, it's not boring. The CG isn't so terrible as to totally throw you off, because at least they're doing creative stuff with the bad CG.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they know that what people are coming there for, whereas all the others that weren't from that group seem to have this sort of like, we're not really trying at all. We realize that we had you by the ridiculous title, and maybe because we've got like a failed 80s pop star in it, and other than that, why do we give a shit?
You know, yeah, it's hard to make that last 90 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas like Sharktopus is still, I think, the best of these that I've seen.
It's so silly that you can't help but enjoy it.
Absolutely.
And our second question in the letterbox is from Jonathan Martin, who asks, have you ever bought a Blu-ray or DVD you already own because the box was nicer? Also, what do you think of Steelbooks? So I don't know which part you want to answer first, but
I have never bought one just because the box is nicer myself. Hmm. I'm sure Luke, that's
many
not
times.
True.
Yeah.
I just want the best possible copy of the movie itself. That's really the main thing for me. That
Fair.
Being said, while Steelboxes look cool, they don't comfortably fit on a movie shelf in terms of like putting it in with everything else. So I'm always like, you know,
what
I'd rather
mean?
Just have like a Steelbox. When you get like a Steelbox, it's always like misshapen. It's a different size than everything else.
Really?
You know, yeah.
I haven't had this.
I wish they would all be more uniform. I know that's me, but I prefer.
No, I haven't encountered that.
I like
so
this.
I don't know
I like
if they're like maybe Amazon is squishing your packages.
I like simplicity.
I do too. I'm a big fan. Dude, I made fun of you because your heights are the wrong size.
Yeah, no,
like,
that's not my choice. I got nothing to do with that.
No, I know. Yeah, no, I have absolutely done this. I'm with Chris on this. Like, for me, the biggest thing is like for example, I own like 9 copies of Watchmen.
Yes, you do.
Because the only Blu-ray that was available in the States for a long time was the director's cut.
Which
and
is
if
not
you wanted,
as good.
And in fact, still, if you want the theatrical cut on Blu-ray, the only way to get it is to import the UK Blu-ray. Or to import from another location. Because even like the big definitive Ultimate Collection only has a theatrical cut on DVD. Which is retarded. I don't know why
that is weird.
I don't know why that's the case. On both of them. On the one that was out of print for a long time, the newer one they've just put out. So, for a lot of films that I own multiple copies of, it's because of, you know, a special feature or a cut or something like that. But the most recent wave of steelbooks that Paramount put out, I thought were really, really impressive. And in particular, I really liked the art on the Chinatown steelbook a lot better than the previously released Chinatown Blu-ray. And so the discs are the exact same, but I spent the money on the steelbook. Because I liked the art better.
Remind me how many copies of Dodgeball we owned at one point.
At one point, we owned like 5 copies of Dodgeball, but that's not important.
I think the only thing that right now I own 2 copies of specifically for like different things is Chasing Amy, which is still my favorite Kevin Smith film, but the Criterion version has so a many cool ton of features. Extra features yeah. that are awesome, but they don't have a Blu-ray version of right. that. The Blu-ray version of it does look great and even has, I believe, a few features that aren't even on the Criterion.
Right, like, but to have everything, you need to have the DVD, the exactly. Criterion DVD and the Blu-ray.
Yeah, yep. so I got both.
I'm a proud owner of both of those as well, sir. Yeah,
just saying.
But yeah, I enjoy Steelbooks, to answer the second half of that question. I think they look good. I think they're an interesting format. The problem is, as Chris pointed out, they get bent really easily, despite being called steel, because yeah. they're not made out of steel. Or maybe they are, and it's just a really pliable form of steel.
But you know what I want to see them release? I want to see them release that Shaq movie Steel in a steelbook.
There you
That's go. What I want.
And that
you're the only person in the world that wants that.
Yeah, I would buy the it? Shit out yeah. of that.
Yep.
Like, yeah. maybe double feature it with Kazam for extra terribleness?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah. I don't know what to do with you.
Well, thank you guys for your questions. We're going to close the letterbox now and get on with
the reviews.
And we're going to start with a little film called Bullet to the Head, which is Walter a quirky Hill. Romantic comedy about two gunsmiths who... no, it's not at all. It's based on a graphic novel, and it stars Sylvester Stallone as growly big man go boom.
Yeah, graphic novel.
Who falls in love with Jason Momoa for his long flowing locks.
This beautiful woman with a ponytail named Jason Momoa.
Based on the graphic novel, Duplom Dons La Man Tits. Because there's a lot of those in this movie, but the big muscular kind.
Yes.
Ooh, ah.
Not even the Rock's peck pop of love could have saved this film.
Just the fact that Christian Slater in it probably should tell you something.
It should.
In this day and age. Uh-oh, something went terribly wrong.
Yeah.
With Walter Hill's career.
This is a tragic, because I fucking love Walter Hill.
Who doesn't love Walter Hill?
48 Hours, Streets of Fire, The Warriors, Last Man Standing. I mean, this guy's made some incredible...
The Driver.
Oh, my God. God, The Driver's so good.
Actually, I'm curious, because I know he's made a lot of movies, and I know I like quite a few of them, but I know there's also quite a few that aren't that good.
Well, either, I mean, and so.
Shenanigans. You bite your tongue, sir.
Not only is he involved with movies that he directed, but I mean, he's also credited as one of the guys on the story for Alien. I mean, he's been involved in a shit ton of just great movies. That's
and
not to say
TV
he has
shows.
Yeah, and TV shows. And that's not to say he hasn't made bad movies in the past, but this one, it was just like, okay... This is, like, modern era Walter Hill. We're all very excited to see what he does with it. And I'm not even saying that a lot of this is necessarily his fault. It's just I was hoping for a little bit more from a Walter Hill film.
I was hoping for a lot more, quite yeah. frankly, because this movie was a pretty big disappointment for me. I know some people who actually really enjoyed it. And
I think it's okay.
It starts off... Yeah, that's the thing, is it's just okay.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because certain scenes really work.
Yeah.
But then everything else totally doesn't. You know, like with yeah. Walter Hill, I expect the characters to be a lot stronger than they are here.
I think from an extremely technical aspect, and I'm not just talking about like the, you know, the cinematography and things like that, but actually like script functionality, it's competent. But as far as like the two things you have to have, I mean, this is another example of Walter Hill's what he calls sort of the anti-buddy movie, you know, like things that he did with like 48 Hours.
Sure.
But what you absolutely have to have for that is not only a chemistry between the two characters, but the two characters have strength individually. And I feel the problem is, one, there is absolutely no chemistry between Sylvester Stallone and...
Sung Kang.
Who I really like. Like, I think he's... I think a lot of people blame Sung Kang for this, and I think that's the wrong way to go, because I think he's a really talented actor.
It's not a performance issue.
No, it's a character issue.
But his character, that's what I was saying, is his character, there's nothing to that character that he right. could stand on his own. So
yeah, they give him nothing interesting to do in this film. In fact,
he can use a phone. That's his whole character definition.
He's kind of a little bitch the way he's written.
And, yeah, totally.
And
this,
and I think one of the things about this only really bugged me is that it felt like just one of those roles that an actor like Stallone takes because he's like, oh, this movie's all about me and it's all about how awesome I am and what a cool character I am and I get almost all the screen time. And look, even with Jason Momoa, who's turning into this big action star right now, it's about me whipping his little bitch ass even though I'm like 3 times as old as he is. You know, like it felt like a vanity film.
Like an ego stroke.
Yeah, exactly. But the story here...
I can real quick. Yeah. I can totally see how the film can come off that way, but just from all the interviews that I've ever heard with Stallone, he doesn't strike me as that type of guy anymore. Like, he seems very quick to talk about the up-and-coming guys, to give a lot of credit to Jason Momoa and to talk about, you know, the people that he wants to bring into the Expendables franchise. And I don't know. I feel like from what I have seen from him, that doesn't strike me as his motivation.
Well, see, the thing with him, though, he always feels like, yeah, I do want to help out these people. I want these up-and-coming people to be in my films as long as they understand that I'm still the baddest ass guy here. And that's made really clear in everything that he does, generally speaking.
I will say this for Stallone, in terms of this being an overarching retrospective of his career. He has played a gorilla so convincingly throughout the entirety of his career.
Was he in Gorillas in the Mist?
That they have finally given him a character named Bobo.
Bobo. Yeah.
He's playing a fucking gorilla in every sense of the word.
Yeah, he's an anti-hero. He's a New Orleans hitman that he and his partner kill a corrupt cop right in the beginning. Although Bobo, we find out very quickly, has a heart because he can't bring himself to kill a prostitute who saw the crime, who's totally innocent. He can't bring himself
to
kill
And that's why his partner Coco gets killed.
Yeah, so but basically because he left the prostitute alive, the people involved who signed the thing in the first place are like, okay, well, now we got to kill Bobo, which they send Jason Momoa after him, who manages...
They send Momo after Bobo.
Yeah, they send Momoa after Boboa. Rocky Balboa. Oh, my God. There's, like, a whole code, like, to the Bible or something here. You know? The bullet to the head code hidden deep inside the script, such as it is. Anyway, Washington, D.C. Detective Taylor Kwan, played by Sung Kang, for whatever it's worth, arrives in New Orleans to investigate the death of the cop who they killed in the beginning, and he finds himself, basically, to make a long story short, he finds himself trapped between a rock and a hard place, or Stallone in a hard place. The Rock's not in this movie.
That's true.
But where he's forced to work with this guy he knows is a, you know, hired killer, because they're the bigger bad guy, played here by Adewale Akinnuoye.
Mr. Echo.
Mr. Echo, as he will always be known.
is after both of them at this point. So they're forced to work together reluctantly to survive this guy. And, you know, there's all these sequences that felt like they should have been awesome.
You know what?
And then they just, they just kind of dwindle out. Even the big fight at the end.
Oh, see, I think that one is awesome.
I thought it was like, starts cool, and but it's filmed really poorly for hand-to-hand combat stuff. I'm like, wow, great conceit. It even looks like maybe it was choreographed well, but it's filmed badly.
Here's another example of like,
I thought it was filmed just fine.
Way too close up. It's hard to tell what anybody's actually doing. It's one of those like, okay, well, we know they're moving and hitting each other, but that's about as much as I can tell you about what's actually happening.
I gotta disagree with you there.
Hearing you summarize the plot, I think I figured out overall what I didn't like about this movie is that the entire film, everything that happens in the movie, is exactly as forced as their partnership. Like, the way that they're kind of thrown in together and it's just like, here, be a team, is kind of how the whole movie functions. It's just like forcing every particular aspect of it. Like, oh, that's his daughter. Oh, you know, he's a badass killer. He has no conscience. No, so he has to, you know, Stallone has to take him down because he does have a conscience. And, oh, he, like, this whole rule about no kids and no, like, that seems forced. Every aspect of this film seems as forced as their partnership.
Yeah, agreed. Even like I said, it's just poorly written, ultimately,
yeah,
is its biggest problem. I mean, like I said, I have problems here and there with other stuff, but ultimately it wasn't a great script and it needed more balance with the characters. It needed more zing moments. It needed, quite frankly, funnier punch up in it because it tries to be funny. And most of the time you just go, huh.
Yeah, and Stallone inexplicably narrates the movie because apparently Tom Waits wasn't available. So they went with the next most gravelly voiced, incoherent person, and they were like, yeah, this sounds like a great idea. Let's have Stallone narrate.
Yeah, ultimately, yeah, watchable, certainly. Has good moments in it, but it's completely forgettable.
And was the movie sponsored by Bullet Bourbon? Bullet Bourbon keeps turning up throughout the course of the film.
Well, it is called Bullet to the Head.
No, I get that, but
Bullet,
it's like...
to the Head.
Why do you need multiple references to
and
Bullet
speaking
Bourbon?
Speaking of Bullet
Bourbon... Oh, that's good stuff.
That's good stuff. Yeah,
indeed. Like, but there's only one special feature on here, which I thought was weird for a major Hollywood film. And it's a 9 minutes, like, behind-the-scenes featurette on which this should tell you everything you need to know about the film. The actors and the people involved, if not all out apologizing for the movie, are definitely making excuses. Like, Christian Slater's like, you know, it's, you just gotta kind of, you know, turn off your brain and enjoy it. And it's like, Okay.
Problem number one.
Uh-oh. They left that in the special feature.
Christian Slater, who's a pretty small part in this movie. In fact, it was a point where I was like, okay, I used to love Christian Slater. I think everybody did.
Hey, everybody liked True Romance.
Well, and Heathers.
Oh, I know.
You know, back in the day, mm-hmm. Christian Slater was pretty cool. He just, after a while, we got tired of seeing him do his Jack Nicholson impression and nothing but. And here I'm like, he's one of those actors, if somebody like Tarantino got a hold of him and said, I have the perfect role for you in a new film that's going to make people love you again, I'd believe it, because I think he's got
which
real charisma.
Which is kind of what happened with True Romance.
I mean, even Martin keeps sort of insisting that like he actually has been on really good TV shows that no one was watching but him. So,
convenient!
Because they didn't last, and I'm certainly not going to seek him out. But yeah, I'm like, maybe this is the film that's going to make him cool. He has, like, early on, and I'm like, oh... Christian Slater, he's not too bad. And then, oh, wait, now he's not in.
Oh, there he goes.
There he goes.
In the full-on cartoon mode.
Yeah, he goes by like a person on top of a float in a parade. You're like, oh, there he is. Oh, there he goes. He's around the corner.
Grand Marshal of the Bullshit Parade.
All right.
Well, Bullet to the Head was a misfire, so we're
going to
move on.
Although the sequel, Woodford Reserve to the Chest, is going to be terrific.
Yes, indeed. Wild Turkey to the Gullet.
Knob Creek in your crotch.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, that's not pleasant. That's not where it's supposed to go.
Well, why don't we talk about Boondock Saints 2? I'm actually really surprised I haven't seen this film.
Why are we talking
about Boondock Saints 2?
Because they just came out?
Just released the director's cut of it.
Oh. I was like, it's been out for a while. Remind me why we're talking about this.
You know, the thing is about Boondock Saints, the original, I understand why people hate it. And there are people who hate it.
Why do people hate it?
That just blows my mind.
No, I
get it. Salisbury's not even aware of this. Most of your friends, most of our like colleagues in the movie critic world hate this movie.
Like, passionately hate.
This is like being told there's no Santa Claus. Like, what are you talking about?
I'm dead serious. It blows my mind, too.
Boondock Saints, it reflects a lot of stuff that was popular in other movies right at that moment. It wasn't like very delayed with it, but it's, you can see where it was taken from. It was taking a lot of stuff from comic books that were popular at that time. And it's a slight film in its own way. It's funny. It doesn't have a lot of depth to it, quite frankly. It's just fun. And if you don't find it fun, okay, hey, I can get it.
It represents the best of the, like, Quentin Tarantino knockoff. You know, like in the years following Pulp Fiction, there was a host of affectations, like Quentin Tarantino affectations. And I think Boondock Saints is probably my favorite because it, despite being beholden to a lot of what Tarantino was doing, like you said, it's drawing from a number of other wells in addition to that.
Yeah, and it's goofy, violent, like a fanboy film. It's a movie made for fanboys, and on that level, it does in fact work. I enjoy the hell out of the first Boondock
Saints. And I really like the first Boondock Saints as well. I think part of what has maybe poisoned the well to some degree, and I've forgotten the name of, there was a documentary that came out
about
kind
the director.
That focused on Troy Duffy. Mm-hmm. And showed a couple of things. One, that the dude is a giant asshole. And two, that it seemed like he kind of lucked into a lot of the things that made Boondock Saints successful. And so, and yet he has this giant ego.
Overnight is the name of the documentary.
And so I think a lot of the ill will towards Troy Duffy has inspired more ill will towards Boondock Saints.
Like,
as well.
Retroactively.
I would agree with you to some level, but I knew people right when it came out.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are people that don't care for the film, but I feel like that didn't help anything.
It's a goofy fantasy that is super violent, and I think a lot of people were turned off by the fact that it was very much a comedy in more ways than not, but it is so brutal and sadistic with its violence in it. You know, I mean, the two main characters here, played by Sean Patrick Flannery and Norman Reedus, I mean, they're it's hard to call them cold-blooded killers because all they do is laugh and joke with each other the whole time. I mean, they're like every, like, close brothers you've ever seen anywhere else. They love the shit out of each other, but they also fuck with each other all the time.
Sure,
you know, they're fun to watch together on screen. So it's no surprise that even with all the problems that Troy Duffy has had, like, nobody wants to work with this guy except for these actors who apparently are constantly defending him, going like, I don't know what you're talking about. We love Troy. He's great.
Well, I'll tell you this. Prior to Walking Dead, I would have said it's because they're having trouble getting work.
Right, but now
Norman Reedus has had such a resurgence on Walking Dead.
And this Boondock Saints 2 was made well before.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. This came out in 2009, a full 10 years after Boondock Saints. Norman Reedus looks none the worse for wear. Sean Patrick Flannery, on the other hand, I don't know what's going on with him, but he definitely had seen better days. He looks like... I don't know. He looks like one of those actors where you like, you know, he's just been drinking for 3 years straight. Isn't that even so much that he put on weight as that he's a little puffy and his face details have sort of blanded out.
Some gin blossoming going on.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Like, I don't know if that's what happened, but something like he doesn't look like the same guy even. But the idea here is it takes place 8 years after the events of the original. And they've been, after everything they did in the original, they hook back up with their daddy, El Duce, played by, what's his name? Billy Connolly.
Billy Connolly,
great,
yes.
Billy Connolly. And you know, they're living, like I said, they're living on an island. Like, okay, we did what we had to do, now we got away because we don't want to have to deal with the FBI, the police, or any of that shit. But apparently someone's trying to frame them for a murder of a priest back in Boston, and they're not gonna have any of that. As far as they're concerned, they're legends, like vigilante legends for good. Yeah. So they're like, all right, fuck that, we're going back to the US, deal with this. Where they go back and they're end up in basically redoing the events from the first film, because this is fan service. And nothing but fan service. It's redux things of things that happened the first. So you got William Dafoe as the kind of crazed FBI guy who can see what's going on with the crimes that happen, and we see him like reenacting it around him, like the actual thing happening. It was a unique storytelling device at the time that worked really
well.
And
one of the best parts of the original movie, frankly.
Here they redo it with Julie Benz, who plays a person who is a protege of William Dafoe's character.
Of course she
does the same type of thing. And they do indeed make her character have a pretty interesting turn, like much like they did with William Dafoe, and they sell it more than they don't. Clifton Collins joins the cast here as a guy who was like this huge fan of the Boondock Saints and what they did, and now that they're
back, the new Rocco.
He wants to be the new Rocco, and very much they play him as that sort of the dumber guy, but they actually give him a little bit more competence, a little more stuff to do. Peter Fonda plays one of the main bad guys here. There's interesting stuff here and there, but ultimately it does feel like kind of an afterthought to the original Boondock Saints. Like, hey, fans demanded it, here it is. We didn't really put a lot more work into it. We just rewatched the original 10 times and went, oh, this is the stuff that people liked. That being said, this is the director's cut that just came out. And you go, okay, great. What does that mean? 3 more minutes of stuff? No, I did not get a chance to watch this considerably longer version. This is 2 hours and 18 minutes. The original is one hour and 57 minutes long, which is also included with this on a release. So it's a much longer release. I agree with the one critic here I'm reading from online describing the differences. I thought the original ran kind of long as it was, but that being said, he was saying the extra stuff actually suits the film, doesn't take away from it. The director's cut comes with a tribute to the producer, commentary with Troy Duffy and the lead actors, commentary with Troy Duffy and William Dafoe, oddly, because he's only in this for like 5 minutes or something. And it was one of those big cover-up secrets, like, William Dafoe's not in it, he's not returning, he's not coming back.
Oh shit, there he is.
I was just looking at this. I was laughing because I was looking at this picture of David Della Rocco, who played Rocco.
Yeah.
I'm looking at him now, and he looks just like our friend Brad McCarg.
He does.
Entirely.
There's a new feature at Saints Off Script that deals with the filming of this. There's a bunch of little stuff. The theatrical cut has its own extras. Assumably, it's the same disc that was previously released for this. So, I don't know. If you were a fan of this movie already, this is the better version to get, quite frankly. It definitely is. But if you really don't care that much, you're going to continue to not care. If you were just about the original, this is not going to change your mind about the Boondock Saints world. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving on from there, let's talk about a little film called 42. Which I assume is about the number of shots that you and I usually take.
No, it's the ultimate answer to life, the universe, and everything. Come on.
That's 42.
That's 42. Yeah. We just don't know what the question is. I reviewed this in the theater. This is directed by Brian Helgeland? Helgeland? Never been quite clear about how to pronounce his name. I think it's Helgeland, but I'm not sure. But he is a screenwriter, film producer, and director who wrote L.A. Confidential, won the Oscar, wrote Mystic River, wrote A Nightmare on Elm Street for The Dream Master.
Let's leave that one out.
Let's not
mention that one on the air.
Hey, everybody has first times, right? He wrote 976 Evil, for God's sake.
Okay.
Winner, Night's Tale, Payback.
All right.
I like Payback.
The Postman.
Who doesn't like Payback?
I love Payback.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, his career is pretty damn good as a writer. This is, I believe, one of the first films he directed. He did A Knight's Tale. He directed that. But
he also directed The Order.
So,
oh, okay.
So I guess this is the first
Heath Ledger.
I was going to say this is
assume?
The first film he's directed that didn't star Heath Ledger.
But this is the story of baseball great Jackie Robinson, which I find to be one of the most inspirational sports stories that there is. Period.
Nothing, and that's coming from somebody who doesn't like sports.
But I love sports movies.
Because
ironically.
You should. Absolutely.
Sports movies are great because you take this thing
they're inherently
that's
cinematic.
Potentially mm-hmm. interesting and actually throw a story around it.
Yeah. Hi-yo.
And I'm like, wow, that I can get with. Yeah. But, you know, if they like at every baseball game, it started off with like a little behind the scenes film clips of like the rivalries going on between these people and who
they do. They call it Sports Center.
And
they call that paying attention to sports, Chris.
That's way too much time.
Oh,
I would not have watched the.
I don't have time because I pay attention to comic books.
I would not have watched the 12-hour version of Bull Durham. That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough. I wouldn't have had
as much interest.
Now, for those who aren't aware, Jackie Robinson was the first African American player to play in Major League Baseball, breaking the color barrier and generally being just one of the greatest baseball players of all time. I mean, he's not just noteworthy because he was the first. He's noteworthy because he was the first, and the reason he's the first is because he was so damn good they could no longer ignore him.
And this is partially thanks to, certainly as far as this movie is concerned, to the manager of the Dodgers, Branch Rickey.
Branch Rickey.
Who is played here as...
Amazingly!
In another film, it would have been irritating, but here it sets the tone with everything else because everything is done sort of light, like fun movie type of thing. Even the dark stuff, they kind of get past real fast because they're like, we're here to have fun. And Harrison Ford's portrayal of Branch Rickey is this wildly exaggerated character who apparently he was bigger than life type of guy.
Sure.
Is hysterical.
I wouldn't say bigger than life. I'd say more grizzled than life.
More grizzled than life, but he is a riot to watch. It's the best thing I've seen Harrison Ford do in maybe 10 years.
I think what I love about it so much is that Harrison Ford has seemed to not necessarily be in a rut, but just kind of be comfortable for so long.
Definitely.
That to see him step out and try something different, whether you think it completely works or not, and I personally do, I'm 100% for Harrison Ford as Branch Rickey.
Totally.
But... Whether you think it works or not, I think there's a certain amount of appreciation you can have for him trying something outside of his comfort zone this late in his career.
Yeah, agreed, because we usually see him play almost nothing but really dour, grumpy guys these days. And here he's playing, this guy is just full of life, he's fun to be around, he takes no shit from anyone, but he does it in that way of like that uncle you have that you're like, man, I love that guy. I want to be like him when I grow up. And watching him be sort of like the guy clearing the way for Jackie Robinson to do what Jackie Robinson does, for being his sort of spirit animal, even going like, Jackie, I know you have it in you. He's like, what do you want me to do? Fight back? No, I want you to not fight back.
I want you to have the guts to not fight back.
Yeah, like he's all these great moments like that. I mean, and I think in many ways, there are two hearts to this film. One is Harrison Ford, who's so good you can't take your eyes off him in any scene he's in. And the other is just the story of Jackie Robinson, which no matter how you did it, even if you made an incredibly shitty movie around it, you'd still have to give that movie some credit for just having one of the most inspirational stories there is.
Because it's a great story.
It's based around. It's such a good story. There's even a lot left out in this film with the Jackie Robinson story that's great, that you're like, wow, there's room for another three Jackie Robinson movies here.
Right.
Talk about different aspects of stuff
so
that
43
happened.
And 44.
But yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that said, like, the movie moves really quickly. Like, we're sitting there in the first act, like, it doesn't waste any time at all. Like, the setup is very quick, like, to the point that Brian and I were making jokes that people had teleporters because we go from, like, Brooklyn to California.
It was literally, like, you would see him playing in like, I can't remember if it was Alabama or Mississippi, but you'd see him playing there, and at the same time, you'd see a scene in Branch Rickey's office, and Branch Rickey's like, go get me Jackie Robinson.
Yeah. And in the very next scene,
he walks off the field, and Branch Rickey's guy is right there, and it's like, did you teleport here?
What just happened? Yeah.
So they're wasting no time.
Not at all.
Part of it, they're filming it like it's a pop fantasy. They're filming it like it's not even a true story, almost. Like,
right.
It's so cartoonish at points, but effectively so. As a person who's a big fan of the story of Jackie Robinson, having seen the original story of Jackie Robinson starring Jackie Robinson, you go, I feel like this story should be taken a little more seriously than this. I mean, I couldn't help it. It was a thing that may not be a fair criticism, but it was something that stuck in my craw a little bit, that this is one of the great stories, and I felt like I was watching a made-up thing completely. John C. McGinley is really good at this.
I love
John C. McGinley
Red Barber.
Fantastic.
Alan Tudyk as the, like, completely racist piece of shit.
Alan Tudyk, who says
Ben
the
Chapman.
N-word... who says more the N-word more than the entirety of Django Unchained, and he's one character.
But he's great in this, and they use him to good effect, but even so, they're exaggerated to this high point that the fact that Chadwick Boseman, who plays Jackie Robinson, is playing it very down, he's playing it very realistically and very close to the hip, that at points, he becomes the least interesting thing in the film. He becomes more of a symbol than an interesting performance in and of itself, because everyone else is so high, and he's just trying to play reverently the serious Jackie Robinson.
I mean, I guess I can agree with what you were saying about the Jackie Robinson story, if you've seen that, but I think this movie actually works really well where it is paying a lot of respect to the story of Jackie Robinson. I mean, it's keeping things light to a certain degree, but I think it manages to hold in those darker moments and the important moments, I should say, and play them off the way that they should be. And I also think, going back to John C. McGinley for a second, I don't know if that guy studied broadcasting in the 30s and is some sort of, like, time lord, but his... like color commentary. Baseball commentary. His baseball commentary as a 30s era broadcaster is sensational. It's like, oh, a little bit of a rhubarb now in center field. Yeah, having a chin waggle with his manager.
It was
like,
really a missed opportunity to not do a commentary track with just him on this, going the whole movie like that. That would, can you imagine? That would have been worth
Harrison
buying
Ford
it for.
Rolling out of bed today, putting on his grumpiest shoes.
I do want to say, I want to disagree a little bit, just in that I think, first of all, I think we can both agree that Chadwick Boseman does a fantastic job.
He does. Yeah. He just feels like maybe he's doing a fantastic job in the wrong Jackie Robinson movie.
Okay, that's where I'm going to disagree a little bit. I still found his performance really interesting, and I didn't think everyone else was so exaggerated.
Other than
so
maybe
as
Alan
to
Tudyk.
Detract from him. Well, Alan Tudyk, yeah, but
and Harrison Ford.
Maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know.
I mean, even if he wasn't exaggerating,
I guess the point is that you found it detracting from the story and from the performance, and I didn't.
Okay.
So I won't disagree that it's exaggerated, because it certainly is, but I'll disagree about where we're drawing the line
But would you agree that, once again, Lucas Black, who plays a pretty major role in this, proves that he's just not a very good actor at all?
I'll be really honest. I was about to speak for Brian and I will only speak for myself when I say that I can no longer see Lucas Black as anything other than his character in Tokyo Drift.
Me neither.
And so I honestly can't, I can't give an accurate answer to that.
That's
all I could say every time he was on screen.
Luckily, he had a completely different race issue in this movie than he did in Tokyo Drift.
You've been waiting so long.
I have been waiting to use that joke.
I wonder if he was in Japan doing that. All these people was like, you call it a sling braid?
So yeah, I mean, he may be a great actor. He may be a terrible actor. I don't know. I just see the kid from Tokyo Drift all the time.
Yeah, I think for me, that's where the movie comes together the most, is when you have those moments where these reluctant teammates finally realize, like, fuck it, we're on the same team and we're tired of other people giving Jackie shit.
It becomes that
dynamic where it's like, you know what, he's our little brother and we can pick on him, but we're fucking sick and tired of you guys doing it. And I kind of like that, because it does sort of speak to most team mentalities in organized sports. Take the race issue out of it completely, it just speaks to how, you know, team dynamics tend to function in professional sports.
And ultimately, I think this is a good movie. I just think it could have been an Oscar-worthy film, and they just weren't even going that way. They're like, we don't want to go for an Oscar film. We want to go for a fun film that you take your family to, you laugh about, and your kids go, wow, was that real? Yes, it was. And he was a big inspirational guy.
Right. I will 100% agree with that. I think that's a spot-on assessment.
They easily could have made it more important and a better film,
They could have explored the emotion more.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, obviously you had some problems with it, and when Brian and I watched it, we shared some insights about some issues that we had with it as well. They're just different issues, like, especially from a character standpoint, like, his teammates are never really fully explored.
No.
Like, even to the point of just knowing their names. And so at the end, when you get like, here's what happened to this guy.
Yeah, you get like the American,
this guy, like, I didn't know that dude's name.
Yeah, you get
so,
like the American Graffiti ending for people we don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's the little kid character who's obviously important, and you know from the setup scene with him and his mom that he's important. But again, we don't get his name until the very end, and really, we get like three scenes with him, and it's like that. I feel like that was meant to be a bigger part.
Yeah,
I think that is only there to segue into, and I liked what it segued into, which was the, hey, by the way, the number 42 is the only one retired on every professional baseball team.
Right.
And hey, every April, you know, the teams wear number 42 as a, out of respect. Like, I think it was just like, sort of like, we're going to segue out of what happened to these guys in text to modern day, the legacy of Jackie Robinson. But I think, yeah, they're not, the other characters, the other players aren't fully developed enough. The other problem I has, there are a couple of scenes that are in there for absolutely no reason.
What it feels like to me is it feels like they had like a 3-hour cut of this film and they were trying desperately to figure out how to cut it down to like a 2-hour movie. And as a result, some stuff got left in that doesn't pay off.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's part of why I was frustrated. I was like, it feels like there's a better movie in here than we ended up getting, which is still a good movie, but it feels like it was like on its way to being a truly great
film.
Yeah,
it could have been a great movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Not quite. I think we would all agree. It's not quite a great movie.
Not quite great, but I think it's really close.
I liked it a lot.
So close.
I enjoy it.
I'm also a little disappointed that the extra features here are not really what you would expect with something like this. You get, like, two behind the scenes. Only one of them is about like a period piece, but like, hey, here's what was really going on at that time. And it's only 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
There isn't a ton of archival footage and documentaries about this period of time in baseball, about Jackie Robinson specifically. And there's nothing here really worthwhile there. There's a short feature for 9 minutes. You get former athletes and baseball players talking about Robinson's trials in the majors, but it's just not. You should expect more, and it's almost like the extra features have the same problem here that the movie film itself does.
Absolutely,
you know?
And it's one of those few situations where I'm almost hoping for a double dip.
Yeah,
you know, I'm hoping for that like 2-disc director's cut.
Well, considering they're listing the DVD copy as a special feature, it's like, guys, that's cheating.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, that's not a special feature.
True.
Well, Brooklyn, we're gonna go hard to our next movie.
We're
gonna go soft maybe to our next
movie. We're gonna go mid-chub.
Yeah. And that is okay, first of all, before we move on, all
right,
can we talk about how weird it is that they used Jay-Z's Brooklyn We Go Hard in the trailer for 42? And it's like, yeah,
because
I
of
get
the
it.
Specific lyric.
I get it. There's a specific lyric that says Jackie Robinson, but the rest of that line is when I run base, I dodge the pin.
Yeah, he's talking about
like,
running drugs and not getting caught.
Yeah, that seems inappropriate.
And that line is in the trailer, not just the Jackie Robinson line.
That's
very good.
I jack, I rob, I sin.
Oh man, I'm Jackie Robinson.
I have a feeling that Jackie Robinson, if he was alive, would probably be offended by the use of that song in this.
Probably.
Film.
I don't know. I
like the idea that Jackie Robinson and Jay-Z are tight.
That's true. Well, moving on to our next film, and that is going to be Solomon Kane at long last, making its Blu-ray debut in the States, for fuck's sakes. I saw this at Fantastic Fest in 2009.
Me too. That was the last time. I have not watched this new release.
And
I have not watched
vanished.
It since.
It vanished from the earth.
Corey and I even did an interview with the director of this, who was a really, really nice guy. And we were like, it was hard because we'd already seen it. And I was not a crazy big fan of this movie. I was like, you know what? It's good, sort of. But it's kind of like, you made a better version of what the hell is that one with Hugh Jackman as the
Van Helsing?
It's like you made a better Van Helsing, you know, but not by a giant leap. And it's a shame because I love this character, Solomon Kane, created by Robert E. Howard,
who also did Conan.
I mean, terrific character, this brutal Puritan with a dark past who goes around killing douchebags in olden times.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's the man of God who will kill you with bullets with crosses marked on him or some shit like that. I don't know. But here you got James Purefoy starring in the title role that couldn't feel more different to me than those original comics if they
tried.
Well,
I mean, that is what I keep hearing is sort of the downside of this. Now, being somebody who hasn't read a single issue of Solomon Kane.
And I did come in with a bias, to be sure.
Well, I mean, yeah, I can't have that same problem with it because I don't know what his origins are from the comics. I will say I am a big fan of this movie. I like the fact that they were able to do on a shoestring budget what a lot of, like, the quote-unquote darker superhero Hollywood movies have not been able to do, and that's give us an interesting character, give us some really sort of fascinating conflicts for him, and frankly, I like the effects work a lot in this. Like, that opening scene where they're invading that hall and there's, like, things in the mirror coming out and grabbing people, I'm like, for what this movie must have cost, that's fucking impressive.
$40 million's not chump change. I mean, that's still a halfway decent budget for this type of film.
I guess that's true, but I mean, it's still way less than, you know, most, you know, movies of this type would cost anymore. And I don't know, I was really enjoying the relationship between Purefoy and the family led by the now unfortunately deceased Pete Postlethwaite. And I like the idea of a character who has to decide, you know, if he's going to be heroic, knowing that there are consequences even to the good in him, because if he makes that decision to go and save that girl, he knows he's going to have to kill people, and that puts his soul in jeopardy. And that's, to me, like, that inner conflict of the idea of, like, I'm going to be heroic, and I could still suffer for it. And having to make that, like, do I let this person die and save my own soul, or do I make the decision to rescue them and save them, knowing that it could damn me? Like, that is fascinating.
Well,
to
now
me.
I'm going entirely from my memories from way back in the ancient, far-flung year of 2009. You know, before
the the long, long ago.
Yeah, before cars and such things. the way, way back when. Because I did not get a copy of this, I assume you rewatched it recently. But my memory of just what you're talking about was that would have been interesting if they weren't. If they were taking that a little more seriously and not just playing it for like a sort of goofy video game level, I felt like you would see a level and say amount of good, do, 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 amount of bad, do, 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 do. You know, it's all played for such, it's almost garish in the way that it is by the time you get to the end, that what serious elements there are in there, what new character nuance there is lost in a mass of CG and silly fight scenes.
I could not disagree more.
Distant memories, once again.
Well, I mean, so. I think at the point the guy gets fucking crucified, I think all notions of it being a silly movie kind of go out the window. But I, for me,
silliest crucifixion ever.
It's not a Monty Python sketch, for fuck's sake. But
always look on the dark side of life.
No, I really like this film. I think it deserves its day in the sun, and I'm glad that it's finally... I don't know why it sat around as long as it did. I'm glad it's finally on Blu-ray. I hope people check it out.
Because the Weinsteins bought it.
Because it's the fucking Weinsteins,
man. What is it? Did they just forget what they buy? Are they like a hoarder that they're like, oh yeah, I totally forgot I had this?
No, I'll tell you exactly what it is. They buy stuff so other people can't put it out.
Yeah, that's
probably true. They're that fucking spoiled kids, like, I don't want you to have it. I don't want it, but I don't want you to have it. So I'm going to buy it and stick it on a shelf.
Well, they need someone to help them organize. They need to get the butler.
They need a butler.
In news joke. Sorry, no one gets that. So,
but I really like Selma Kane. I think if you're a fan of kind of those darker, more complex superheroes, and especially if you're a fan of period superhero films, like, I wish they would bring that back. I wish they would do more of those. Like,
period superhero films? Yeah,
I want another Rocketeer. I want another Shadow. For fuck's sake, when are we going to get another Shadow?
I really liked the original The Shadow, and everyone came down on me for it. And I was like, I'm sorry. I will agree that maybe Alec Baldwin wasn't the right guy for this, but ultimately it's a pretty good movie.
It is a good movie.
I like Alec Baldwin.
Fuck yeah. And you know,
and I would say something like Black Death is a little closer to what's going on here.
But. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I dig Selma Kane, and I definitely think if you want to expose yourself to Michael J. Bassett's work, watch this and not Silent Hill Revelations. Jesus Christ almighty.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there, but wow, that was bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, like I said, I enjoyed this, I think, more than I didn't, but even so, it was obviously kind of forgettable for me. I was like, all right, it was another one of those movies that was like, okay, but it didn't really stand out a lot to me, other than it was better than a lot of the other films coming out at the same time that were much worse.
I will solemnly cane you after the show is over for that.
But I am really glad it finally got a home release and a very limited theatrical release. It seems like it's a film that if they marketed it properly, they could have made some money in the theater, and they just didn't try.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the hell was going on there, but yeah, I don't know. It's worth seeing, agreed. And I thought Purefoy was great in the lead role. There's also some nice performances throughout it, but...
Yeah, I like Purefoy a lot.
Yep.
All right, well, moving on from there, we're going to discuss, at long last, the Evil Dead remake.
Woo!
Okay, this always makes me nervous because, you know, I've reviewed this with the guys on the other side I work for, and I apparently was the only one that really, really enjoyed the hell out of it.
I dug the shit out of
it. Oh, thank God. Oh, thank God.
Because I think it's amazing.
I thought this movie was just absolute fun all the way.
I think it's exactly what it was supposed to be.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
exactly what I wanted from an Evil Dead remake.
I can't count how many times I had to listen to these guys who supposedly were hyper familiar with the original Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 saying, well, why didn't they do something like this? Because that was in Evil Dead 2. Why did they do something like... That was an Army of Darkness. Have you ever even seen the original Evil Dead? God damn it. And to be fair, this movie does indeed toy with expectation of stuff that does happen in at least the second film. Mm-hmm. But they're not interested in making a flat-out comedy. They're interested in making one of those, like, it's funny because you can barely take it films. You know? Like, oh my God. And doing it all with practical gore.
Such amazing practical gore.
You can't do a movie that's like this, like the, oh, how much of this can you take? It's so intense, it keeps coming, without doing practical gore. People have tried, and it's just yawn-worthy if you realize it's CG. When it's practical, it'll always be better looking with this stuff, and it proves it unquestionably with this film.
First and foremost, Fede Alvarez, the director of this remake, is staring down, I mean, just from the onset, staring down the barrel of what should be an insurmountable challenge. I mean, remaking Evil Dead. I mean, a watershed horror film in so many different ways that I would never want to be in his shoes. Even if they were like, hey, Brian, remake this movie and we'll give you $30 million. I'd be like, I know, because everyone will hate me.
I mean, let's back up one step from that even and say, here is your first feature film.
Oh, yes. This is his first fucking feature film.
Here is your first feature film to make. Here's whatever, $20 million.
With Bruce Campbell, Robert Tapert, and Sam Raimi staring over your shoulder the entire time as producers.
Just part of that, though, you know, I got to say, they handpicked Fede Alvarez for this.
Oh, yeah.
So there's at least some of that, like, all right, they do like me. They like me. They really like me.
And honestly, when we got to see this at South By and, you know, saw everybody on stage, the cast, the director, Bruce Campbell, unfortunately not Sam Raimi, but, you know, talking about it, and it was clear, yeah, they really did like him. They really liked his version of the vision of this.
Yeah.
And they let the guy run with what it was he wanted to do. And you can tell watching this, it does not feel anything like a Sam Raimi film.
No.
Well, it doesn't feel like an R-rated horror film, for one.
It feels like an NC-17 rated horror film.
Yeah, it's bloody as shit.
I was going to say, you were
possibly the goriest
film. A watershed horror, the original? I call it a bloodshed horror.
Yeah, it is a bloodshed horror.
Because the original is really bloody, but it's all very dated effects, and it feels a little laughable now in that sense, but it's still got that sense of, like, so intense, so like, oh, Jesus Christ, what the fuck? And this manages to do that. If I had a disappointment with this, it's not fair disappointment. It's a comparing to the original, which is that I felt like there's so much time spent in the beginning trying to set up these characters that ultimately you're like, why should I care? You know?
Which
like,
is and funny, because people still bitched about the character.
Yeah, I know.
And I think they did a great job.
And the subplot with her, like, okay, so the main female character played wonderfully here by Jane Levy, who goes through some of the most terrifying experiences an actor probably ever had to do to be in a film.
Yeah.
She does so good, but they try this whole thing where, like, okay, she was a serious drug addict and we bring her out here to try and cure her. And it just went on a little too long.
Okay, but see,
ultimately it pays off. It totally pays off, ultimately, I thought. But it did. It was like, will you guys please get to the part where the dead start being evil?
I was really thankful, actually, that they took the time to develop that subplot, because that, to me, is the motivation that when things start to go wrong... Two things. One, they don't immediately assume supernatural.
Right.
Because they know that she's detoxing and probably going to flip out.
And she's
going
to hallucinate.
And two, because they care about her,
they're
it keeps them
leaving.
From running the second things start going bad.
Right.
So to me, I was like, thank you for like taking the time to establish that, because it keeps the fucking kids in the cabin.
It's a great plot device, because it answers a lot of the questions for you. And it's one of those things where in 2013... You need a real, real good reason for why are these kids going out in the middle of nowhere? Why would they not have cell phones? Why would, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a good reason. It's like, all right, we're doing an intervention. We're not going to have any other distractions. We're just going to sit and we're going to help her get through this. And it's like, I'm 100% on board. Like, it answers so many of the plot questions in a nice, tight little package. I can totally understand feeling like it goes on a little long, but I'm almost willing to say, go on 10 minutes more if you want, because of all of the questions it's able to wrap up.
And I agree with everything you're saying. I think, like, the problem comes down with the criticism people say, like, God, these characters, they're not, like, all that well-developed. I'm like, because they tease you with them continuing to develop them by having that. And then once it gets to, like, not even the halfway point, well before that, and goes, okay, now it's time for fucking Evil Dead movie. So I'll fuck all that other characters. We are going to kill some motherfuckers, and it's going to be awesome.
Well, I guess my question for that is, like, I don't know, like, how much can the characters develop while they're trying to not die slash kill
each
other?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is, like, that other, the part that it goes on as long as it does just seems like more of a tease. The only one whose character really feels like it pays off is Jane Levy, ultimately, where, like, because...
Which, I know we can't talk about it specifically because we don't want to spoil it, but how fucking brilliant was the turn that they gave to that character?
Well, they, in the third act...
I love that.
They take some... ballsy decisions
huge
in what they do with the plot of this film that do, at least for me, and obviously for you guys, pay off in a big way.
Yeah, they do.
And, you know, it's funny that the central mystery of this film is, and everybody, if you've seen the originals, you'll be asking yourself the whole time, so who's the Bruce Campbell character? And that's one of the fun gimmicks that they know that people are going to be asking, and they just have a great time tormenting you with not knowing what the answer to that question is.
And it's so dark and so savage that, you know, it's not pursuant to its marketing, the quote-unquote scariest movie you'll ever see.
No.
But I love
it's
that
intense,
marketing.
Man. Yeah. It is super intense, because when you see how savagely they're going to start killing these people... you're like, oh man, I don't want to be in here anymore. I don't want to be in here anymore. So you do get that intensity. It's not really, you're not really scared as much. You're like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. What's up? Oh.
And yeah, if you're one of those people who's like, oh man, I like to see a film and go be scared. And you're talking about like a ghost story type film or something. This is not that kind of scared.
No.
This is that kind of scared. Like, it's so intense and so bloody and so like constantly in your face that, you know, if you're a person that sounds like something you wouldn't like, you're not going to like
it. It's gut wrenching.
And it's super dark. Yeah. Like we've kind of touched on that, but like, and it's weird to say this because they don't sacrifice some darker humor.
Yeah.
There's still some dark humor in there, but make no mistake. Like, this is like literally like the word evil is, very
apropos.
Correct. Yeah, apropos to what's going on here. I mean, they're not messing around. Like, this is definitely malevolent on a whole nother level. And I love the fact that that's set up from the very first scene.
Yeah.
Like, the first scene is so perfect in that, like, this is the movie we're going to give you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's going to kick your ass.
Hell yes.
And then it does.
I really think this works. And I think that people who really don't like this film that I've talked to are people who... this just was never going to be for them, almost no matter what they did.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I don't think you're the kind of person who likes this kind of horror film.
I think,
because I think for this kind of horror film, they nailed it.
Evil Dead and The Conjuring are neck and neck right now for my favorite horror film this year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I hardly wait till we get a chance to talk about The Conjuring.
Oh, such man. A great horror
blew
film.
Blew me out of my seat.
I would like, talk I about, just yeah, you kiss you, James Wan on the mouth.
You like the scary ghost story film that's really well done that's going to scare the shit out of you? That's The Conjuring.
Absolutely.
But if you like the scary, like, as so bloody you can barely take it film, that's Evil.
That still manages to be a ride. Like, to make no mistake, this isn't like torture porn where it's like, we're going to see how uncomfortable we can make the audience just for the sake of shock.
Yeah.
It's having fun with it. You're just going to, it's going to take you a while to realize that you're having fun with it. And then when you do, like, oh, okay. Yeah. That's kind of awesome.
And there's so many nice little wry nods to the first two films, especially that I think play really, really well.
Totally.
One of the criticisms I heard from people that I'm like, okay, I can at least understand that, but that I thought was fun was the callbacks of people.
Oh,
saying,
I think they're great.
There was just too many of them, and I'm like,
what did you want? It's an expectation
thing.
It's
like they're not.
What
callbacks,
kind of film did you want?
But they're not callbacks that are like non sequiturs.
No, either. They make sense
like, when
in
movies
the context
do that,
of the film.
Yeah, when movies do that, and you're like, what did that have to do with anything?
Right.
Yeah, that's irritating. But here, they're all things that are well within the plot that this film is developing. And so it doesn't really bother me. I just thought they were, in fact, fun.
I think for some people, Evil Dead, the remake, was going to be damned if it did and damned if it didn't. There was just going to be a problem one way or the other. And I think what they managed to pull off is just phenomenal.
Bonus features-wise, you get a commentary with a lot of the actors and the director and the writer. There's a special feature from Fede Alvarez about directing the film. There's a feature with Tapert, Campbell, Alvarez, several of the actors, talking about the legacy of the original films and how hard it was to even decide to remake it. A thing about like how hard it was to act in this, which for Jane Levy especially, when you see this, you'll understand. You're like, holy shit, how the fuck did she let them do this?
Yeah.
I'm just going to say there is a burial scene in this, burying alive scene, that when we saw them talking about this live, like we filmed it like three different ways, completely different ways. So I had to be buried alive three different times for this film. And
wow.
You're like, fuck that.
I was actually fortunate enough to get to interview the cast during South By. And the first question I asked them was like, So before you guys signed on, you read the script, right? Like, you knew what was going to happen to you in this movie.
But one interesting note before we finish up with this is that, like, when we were there, they were really poo-pooing the idea of ever bringing this new trilogy they want to do into the storyline of the original. But apparently, since at WonderCon, they have said, okay, we changed our minds. Now that's what we want to do. Whereas the plan is they do a sequel to this. They do another Evil Dead film in the original series, which they're now calling Army of Darkness 2 instead of Evil Dead 4. I don't know why. I guess to prevent any confusion.
Yeah. Because, you know, Rambo has to be involved.
And then make a third film that will be a combination movie, Army of Darkness 3 / Evil Dead 3.
First Blood, Rambo 3.
That will combine the two film series into one final film. And I'm like,
nice.
I've always said, I don't know about it making it just one, but I've always said the way I'd love this to end would be like the vortex at the end of Evil Dead 2, and she's starting to be sucked into it. Like, how do you stop it? And then something happens, and it reverses and starts blowing back out. She's all up against the wall like, what the hell? And it stops with old-ass Bruce Campbell and beat-up armor comes back through into the regular world, and he's on the ground, and she's shocked looking at him. He looks up and just goes, what? And that's the end of the series.
Our ideas for the next Evil Dead movie can be found at oneofus.net, and they do necessarily reflect our opinions at oneofus.net.
Yeah, absolutely they do.
We're going to move on from there to Wild Bill, a 2011 British film directed by Dexter Fletcher.
Have you seen this?
I have, actually. I saw it a few months ago, actually. Cargill came over and was like, hey, I got this movie. I really liked it. I imported it. Let's take a look at it. So we watched it. I dug it. Yeah.
It's not bad, certainly. I just watched this. The story goes around the titular Bill, although he's not all that wild for most of this, played by Charlie Creed Miles. And the reason he's not that wild anymore is because he was in jail for 8 years for some being the wild part of his name. And now he's out on parole, but he's gotten home and he's found his two sons, Dean, played by Will Poulter.
Who's excellent,
yeah, who's
by the
wonderful
way.
And who's been in, what is the
Son
other
of Rambo.
Son of Rambo, which is a great festival.
And he's about
film.
To be in We Are the Millers with Jennifer Aniston.
And he's used to scrub in The Chronicles of Narnia as well.
Yes.
That's the other. I knew I'd seen him in something else. But and he's 16, and the younger brother, Jimmy, who's 11, and he finds out that their mother left a while ago. It's like, well, you know, older brother seems old enough now. You guys can take care of yourselves.
So Dean's been taking care of Jimmy this entire time. And actually, Jimmy is also somebody we recognize. Luke, do you remember where it was?
I don't recall. I'm sorry.
Attack the Block. He's Probs. Probs in Mayhem.
Really? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So they've been fending for themselves, and they don't want this dad back. They're like, we want nothing to do with you. You know, you abandoned us, which seems weird considering they are very forgiving of their mother, but not of him who went to prison and wasn't given, in fact, any choice in the matter as opposed to her. But he doesn't want to be the old Wild Bill. He wants to figure out, he just wants to be left alone at first, but then he starts to become attached to these kids and go, I've got to learn how to be a dad. The problem is that there's some gangsters in town he used to work with 8 years ago, but now have sort of become head of the class, who've incorporated the younger Jimmy into their little crime syndicate there. And Bill doesn't want him in there. He doesn't want his kid to go to jail or get hurt. So he's forced to go out and become wild again to confront his old cohorts.
Indeed. And one of the gangsters here, played by Andy Serkis.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Which was
who's not
bizarre.
In it anywhere near enough.
Sadly. No, but I just was not expecting that at all. I mean, part of the reason, I mean, he's there. He's not in a mocap suit.
Right.
He's not a gorilla or a Schmeagle, or he's just there. He
and it's kind of a basic story. I mean, this is not, like, super original by any stretch of any imagination.
No.
But it's well-filmed, it's well-acted, and in particular, I mean, I think we're all pretty big fans of Son of Rambo, and so we're maybe predisposed to liking Will Poulter. But I think beyond that, I think just watching him as a young actor, I think he's really, really impressive in showing range and emotion, and I'm just very impressed with him as an actor, and a lot of what I like about this film is watching his character.
Watching his character deal with being thrust into a position of being the father figure, and then dealing with his own absent father figure, and how that changes the dynamic of their house, and he's great at handling something that weighty.
It's interesting that for a film like this, and a British film like this, you expect something very different than what you get.
Sure.
But what you get is actually a pretty interesting little, I don't want to go so far as say a gem or anything, but interesting little indie film with great character development, and that does exactly what you don't expect at points. I want to point out, just for fans of the show Misfits, Iwan Rheon, who played the cast of that show, who was the invisible kid, the nerdy one, he actually has it's not a big role, but a reasonable amount of on-screen role here as Pill, one of the young little gangster wannabe guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do recommend it, like we were saying.
Yeah, it's worth seeking out. I just don't think it's going to blow anybody's socks off.
And no, especially worth seeking out now that it's, you know, you don't have to import it from the UK.
Yeah, it's very much worth a watch, but don't expect it to be, like, it's not Snatch.
It's good, but not great.
Yeah, good, but not great.
Well, speaking of things that get snatched, why don't we talk about Kidnapped?
Okay, so Robert Louis Stevenson, of course.
No,
you mean Rabid Dogs, now retitled Kidnapped.
Ah, yes, I do. And I believe that is the first of the two Mario Bava films we're going to talk about.
It is, and this is an odd film for Mario Bava in that, well, for a number of different reasons. One reason is that it was never really even released until years after it was made. It was made in 1974. It was unfinished in terms of editing. Like, they had a lot of footage, nobody put it together, and there was no money to put it out. It wasn't even released until 1998, made in 1974. Kind of fucked up. And in fact, even that version, only on VHS, it wasn't until 2007 until it finally got a DVD release, now changed from the title Rabid Dogs to Kidnapped. This is finally the first Blu-ray release, and although the DVD release offered both cuts that are out there of this, this is only one of them, which is kind of sad. It doesn't have both versions. It seems strange they didn't, because apparently they're pretty different versions. I mean, in fact, the final edited together version was put together at least partially by Lamberto Bava, Mario's son.
His son, Demons.
Had long been dead by the time they got around to reissuing this. But this is interesting more than anything in that it doesn't feel at all like another Mario Bava film, in that it's a crime movie. And he didn't really... I mean, he would do giallo films, but they're very horror giallo. This is more... And it's been compared a lot with Sam Peckinpah.
Which, actually, the original title makes a lot more sense, because, I mean... Peckinpah had did Straw Dogs 3 years before, so...
And the story here, which we talked about last week, Cohen and Tate, about, like...
Oh, yeah.
An abducted kid with two psychopaths who are driving across the country with them. I'd be shocked if that director, Eric Red, had not seen some early cut of this at some point.
Which is funny, because when I was watching Cohen and Tate, the thing I kept thinking was, wow, this takes some interesting Peckinpah-ish turns.
Well, and there you go.
Yeah.
But the story here follows a group of bank robbers who totally fuck up. Well, they're not even bank robbers. They're robbing a payroll at a business. And so they take off. One of them is shot and killed almost immediately on the way out. They're like, fuck, the whole plan is fucked. What are we going to do? So they grab a car and a person who happens to be in the parking garage where they grabbed it, this woman, and they get in the car with her, and it's like, fine, we got a hostage. We're going to take off. They end up getting another, when they have to switch cars, they get another hostage and his son, who's sick. And most of this movie is them driving across the country, dealing with, you know, these people who don't want to be hostages, obviously, who are desperately trying to keep alive, while realizing that these three criminals in here, they are drooling psychotics, practically. One of them is, like, I think
it's a car full of Adam Baldwins.
Yeah, pretty much. One of them is named Blade, and his whole thing is, like, he loves his switchblade so much, he literally sometimes doesn't realize that he's just murdered someone with it. Like, there's a point where he's, like, looking down at one of the hostages in an earlier scene, he's like, oh, shit. Sorry. He's like impaled her through the neck and didn't know.
Wow.
It's just his instinct to do it.
That one's on me, guys.
Yeah, seriously. There's another guy who's just like, who's a lot more like Adam Baldwin. Like, he's just bloodlusty and he's like, I hardly wait to kill someone. This is awesome. We have fun. And he's constantly getting all rapey with the female, like, come on, I'm a raper. And the other guy, the main guy, the older guy, has got that Roy Scheider thing. He's like the experienced guy. He's like, God damn it, will you people fucking calm down? I swear to God, I'm going to kill both of you if you don't stop acting like teenagers. And what works about this so well, and for me much better than Cohen and Tate, is one, these actors are having so much fun with these parts, clearly. It's at points almost a little I Spit on Your Grave-ish, but with a much better script, you know?
That's good.
And the fact that Mario Bava has made a very tense film as you watch these people, because the people that are in the car with them, you really want them to survive. You're very interested in them. They have a lot more dialogue. The relationship between them and the criminals is actually becoming more and more complex as the film goes along, and various things keep getting in the way of what's going on, and it takes some crazy twists along the way. And the ending is one of those, like, no fucking way. It's like, you don't expect a big twist at the end of a movie like this, but wow, there's a big twist at the end. You're like, okay, that was funny. Big points for that.
Kick ass.
Incredibly well directed by Bava. Great script. Good, if over the top, performances by everyone. This is completely worth checking out. Sadly, there's really no extras, but man, it's a lot of fun. It's
high praise for the film.
Like, for a guy who's a horror guy, like, and well known more than anything for horror and giallo, and going so far out of his element with this, even though it is pretty gory at points, it's spectacular. And even Bava was calling it, at the time when he was making it, saying, I think this is going to be my best movie. Like, wow. He was very confident about it and was quite broken by the fact he wasn't able to finish it.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, definitely check that one out. And the other Bava film that I believe they were both released by Kino.
Yeah, which is even better.
The other one is Black Sabbath, which is an anthology horror film of his from 1963.
Blu-rays gathering in my post box. Bow, bow, bow. I don't know. My last name as a critic is Cox. I don't know. I wasn't prepared to do a second verse.
That's okay.
Yeah. That's okay. We'll do Snark at the Moon later. Right. So Black Sabbath is an anthology horror film where, I mean, okay, a couple things about this movie you need to understand going in. One, it's super silly. Like, to the point that the wraparound story is Boris Karloff being dubbed over in Italian, just being like, hey, kids, I'm going to tell you some scary stories.
Yeah.
Here we go. And the ending is like, when it comes back around to him, it's like, okay, I'm going to ride off into the night. And then they pull back and you actually see the fake horse and the guys running around with the fake brand. And it's like, okay, well, that's really bizarre, because the antithesis of that is some of the creepier moments in the stories themselves that don't match that mood whatsoever.
It was an odd choice for a wraparound story, and the only reason I think they even did it at all is because, well, we've got Boris Karloff and we're going to use him as much as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And I think that was their only inspiration there. But yeah, the three stories in here, which couldn't be more different than each other, I thought were all, if not always genuinely very frightening, all genuinely very good. In
yeah.
fact, I would call this one of the best horror anthologies I've ever seen.
I think, I don't know, I think the third one really loses me a lot. Which is unfortunate, because the first half of the third segment is great. And then I think once they start going off to the catacombs and the tombs, it's just like, okay, let's wrap this up. But the first segment is about a woman who's being stalked via telephone. And it's one of those, like, you know, you're alone in the house when a stranger calls type situations. And that has some really great twists to it.
Which, by the way, was a major influence on the coming age of giallo films and everything that happened after that in sort of the, you know, because this was an early color film and for Italy. And it was one of those ones that really set the tone in a lot of ways in the look of giallo to follow.
Well, Bava
can certainly see that.
Yeah, Bava gets a lot of credit as being sort of the godfather of the giallo movement. So, I mean, that's not surprising at all. The second segment is probably the creepiest one for me. It's called A Drop of Water, or...
Oh, no. The second one was The Wordlack.
Yeah, Drop of Water.
Oh, third, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, the second one is this really interesting sort of cultural zombie story, really. But they don't call them zombies, they call them Wunderlachs, where it's like the recently deceased loved ones...
they're supposed to be vampires.
It's funny because it's like the recently deceased loved ones rise from the grave... And they come back and they act like everything's fine, but they're fighting off this craving to feast upon the flesh of their family members who are still living. So it's like, yeah, a little bit of vampire, a little bit like, but all sort of, I think it's like the Russian myth.
It's a very traditional Eastern, even though with Bram Stoker's Dracula, which made drastic changes to the Dracula lore, this is actually relatively close to what was going on in like Transylvania and that part of the world with what they believed vampires were in that term. I mean, it's pretty much how that was. Their vampires come back and they're most interested in killing and transforming into vampires the people they loved the most. Bits and pieces of that appear in other, like, later Americanized or Europeanized versions of the vampire story, but this is pretty true to it. And ultimately what this is more true to than anything is the classic Boris Karloff universal horror films.
Mm-hmm.
They totally, like, Bava here unapologetically is making a universal era horror story here with all the smoke and the dramatic music and the haunted looking moors and crazy, craggy, ruined castles. And I think on that level, he does a terrific job. And also, in fact, stars here as the patriarch of the family who comes back, where you ask yourself the question, Is he fine and just tired and weathered from his long voyage? Or has he become a Wordalak?
Well, what's interesting about that is actually, you know, as we were talking about, it is a sort of form of vampire. It's specifically Russian. And the novel that kind of is the definitive, the novel or novelette, I guess it's called, that is sort of the definitive Wordalak story was written by Tolstoy. And that's actually what they're borrowing from for this segment. In fact, he has a writing credit in that segment. And that, to me, is the creepiest when there's like a little kid outside who's like, when you know people who are dead, and then all of a sudden you hear them coming back toward the house, and it's just like, ooh, that's really chilling. I will say that in that one, there's some really terrible makeup on Boris Karloff.
It's not the best makeup.
But... And I think the problem there is, like, that wouldn't be so noticeable, except that the high-def transfer is so good.
Yeah, agreed.
In that particular, like, the first segment's actually kind of rough.
He's wearing gray grease paint, and you can see places where it's rubbed off.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay. But it is still Boris Karloff, and he's great in his performance in it.
Oh,
and that
sure.
goes a hell of a long way.
Sure. And then the third segment, which is my favorite, is called a drop of something about a drop of water.
The drop of water, which is... basically
the drop of water, yeah.
The
telltale heart.
Yeah, well, never steal anything from a dead person who had magical connections because you're gonna get fucked. It's a horror story we've seen explored in various different forms quite a few times. In fact, it reminded me a little bit of the story in Two Evil Eyes, I believe it was. Remember the thing which was based on, I guess, an old Edgar Allan Poe story?
Yeah, they were doing oh my god, I'm blanking. It was Fulci, I want to say, and somebody in Argento.
No, it was Argento and Romero.
Oh, that's it. Argento and Romero doing Poe stories.
Yeah, exactly. So. In this one, what makes it so great is that it is the scariest on-screen mannequin you have ever
seen. Oh my god, it's terrifying.
In your entire life. And I'm talking even more than Lucas Black. I mean, really.
It is so lifelike.
It was funny. I was, when I was putting together our links so we have stuff we can look up, like, you know, various data on screen, one of the things I was reading was the guy saying, well, when I was getting the screen captures of the image for this, I was so scared I had to go and leave the room for a while because I couldn't look at the image of this mannequin for that long.
And it's just the way they articulated it at points too that's really disconcerting. And I dug that quite a bit.
I did too. I think the only thing that arguably doesn't work in this whole thing is that wraparound story, but it's goofy enough and it's starring Boris Karloff and it's so short, you can forgive it because ultimately this is one of the truly great horror anthologies. And it's Bava at his best. He is doing incredible things as a filmmaker. The cinematography is gorgeous. And each one is so different and so unique. I think I'd have a hard time imagining anybody of any age not getting some enjoyment out of this.
And be aware that the segments are not created equal in terms of their high-def transfer. The first one is kind of rough, but the second one is... Second and third ones are much clearer,
both look,
much sharper.
Yeah, both look much better.
But that could just... why'd you pull up a picture of it? I think it may just be a question of the different elements that they had to use for this Blu-ray. But overall, definitely want to pick this up if you're a fan of Bava, if you're a fan of anthologies. If you're a fan of classic horror in general, I think this is something you're definitely going to want to add to your collection.
In fact, I am going to go ahead and say that this is my pick of the week.
Oh, shit, it's Chris's pick of the week!
I love this. I'm so glad. I'd never seen it, and I swear this has nothing to do with my undying love for the band Black Sabbath, who are, in fact, also completely fucking awesome. But this movie is wonderful. So glad to have it as a part of my collection.
It's Crazy Train.
Yeah.
I think my pick of the week is going to be Evil Dead, just
I'm
for the record.
I'm going to go with Brian, Evil Dead.
All right. Just for the record.
Fuck both of you.
Fuck
That's
you.
That's all right.
Evil Dead was my second choice.
So why don't we move on from there to another collection of short things, which is the Rooster Teeth Best of Shorts.
You know, we were just at the RTX Festival having a terrific time. A lot of fun, a lot of fans out there. And I honestly have not really watched much from Rooster Teeth before this, except for the Red versus Blue stuff.
When that set came out that we reviewed.
The Machinima stuff, which is just them animating stuff from using the Halo set of animations, which Microsoft kindly gave to them to use, and doing a pretty funny series around it. I'd never seen any of their live action stuff or really, in fact, any of their other shows. Now, this collection, which just came out, is in fact two discs. One is just the fan voted upon best of the live action shorts starring. It's weird, too, because this crew of people who star in it, they're also the people who crunch the numbers and do business behind the scenes at Rooster Teeth.
Yeah.
The guys who do programming and do everything else. It's like, That's odd. And considering that's the case, there's some funny people, really funny people. The second disc is sort of excerpts from their podcasts that they have animated in a very intentionally shaky and cheap looking style, but that has lots of very funny jokes in it as well. But surprisingly, a lot of care was put into this collection, even having go so far as having interactive menus with like background jokes going on. Wow. I mean, stuff you don't normally see in a release like this. Lots of bonus features. I mean, it's a lot of fun. And quite frankly, watching the live shorts, which I did, in fact, watch all of, I laughed my ass off all the way through it. I was like, this is better than most television sketch comedy that I see these days.
I think this is telling of how Rooster Teeth feels about its fans, that they would go that extra mile and be like, I know this is just us being goofy and it's just shorts of us, but it's like, if we put out a DVD of it and we expect you to pay for it, we're going to go all out and do the interactive menus and all that.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I was one of those things, like, we've obviously worked with Rooster Teeth. I didn't want to come into this raving about it because I'm like, people are going to go, oh, that's just because you worked with those guys. I don't know any of these guys. I mean, I know some people through email and that's about it. I was shocked that they were as good as they were. I was just waiting for it to take a turn for the awful. And I was going, wow, these guys are really talented comedy writers. These sketches are super clever. Lots of conceits I've never seen before in sketch comedy. No, they're not all the best actors in the world by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of them aren't terribly pretty people to look at either. But that being said, once again, it's a lot of fun. It's very well done. And even if you've never heard of Rooster Teeth, you should pick this up. You're going to have fun with it.
Awesome. Well, I'll have to do that. In the meantime, why don't we talk about Orphan Black Season 1?
Well, you know what? I would, except I don't need to. You know why?
Why?
Because last week's episode of The Original Gentleman, that would be episode 2, that you can also find on oneofus.net, Bo and I go into great detail about the show Orphan Black. For something like 15 minutes, we rant and rave about why this is one of the best shows. You can get this on DVD now from BBC America. It's a Canadian-produced show, the BBC, or Canadian-made show the BBC produces, that has a pretty decent amount of special features on it as well. It's well worth your buck to get, but that's enough about that here. Go pick it up, or go listen to our review on The Original Gentleman.
On The Original Gentleman. So in that case, that's going to bring us to the last title of this particular show, which is also going to be our
giveaway!
And that is Misfits Season 3.
You know, Misfits is a British sci-fi comedy show that the basic idea is that it's a bunch of juvenile delinquents who are doing a work release program, who there's this big storm, and as it turns out, everyone in the immediate area, one can assume probably a couple miles pretty much, got zapped by it to some degree. Like, some people have, like, so little effect they haven't even noticed. And other people have extreme superpowers, including this lead cast of people who are all little pieces of shit juvenile delinquents who now can do amazing things. And the problem is that they keep running into people who also have powers but have turned evil, or the powers in and of themselves make them evil. Like, I think their initial person who was in charge of watching them basically, for all extents and purposes, turns into a zombie. And they're forced to kill him, which is only the first of several people that come in who are supposed to be watching them there as their job, who they're forced to kill for various reasons. And they're not trying to kill people. They just want to be left alone, but they keep having to. And it's a very funny show. The third season, a lot of people were cynical about because they got rid of one of the lead actors of the show. I believe it's Robert Sheehan. Who was the lead sort of loudmouth character on the show. I mean, he's just as big an asshole as everybody else, probably more, but he's the guy who talks the most on the cast. And he left for presumably bigger and better things. And yet, for my money, the third season's the best season of the show so far. What I've seen in the fourth season, I wasn't terribly crazy about, but this third season brings all the arcs of the previous two seasons that have been building to a close, including a wraparound time travel story involving a mysterious superhero that keeps appearing and pulling their asses out of the fire that does cool ninja shit and jumps around and always is wearing all black and a black motorcycle helmet, so you can't tell who it
is. Nice.
Well, that brings it back around, so not only do we know who it is finally, but it makes a really tragic, awesome time travel story that arcs the entire series. they did a spectacular job bringing this to a close, and I really wish that they had ended it with season 3, because season 4, where you've pretty much got none of the original cast left by the time it's halfway through, is a disappointment from what I've seen. 3 is fantastic and very much worth your time. It's not terribly standalone-ish. You kind of have to watch the first 2, but it's a relatively short show. It's funny. It's very R-rated. It's got nudity and cussing. It's got great jokes. It's got lots of cool superhero stuff going on it. I mean, here's an example of the type of superhero humor you can expect in this, or weird sci-fi. The Robert Sheehan in the second episode of the first series has a sequence where he's making love to this total hottie who like finds him, grabs him, and goes, come on, we're going to fuck, which is not what he expects because he's a little wormy guy. You know, he talks a big game, but that shit doesn't happen to him. So she's riding on top of him and he's like, yes, yes, she's, I mean, you're watching, she's full on naked. You as an audience member are like, great, this is awesome. I like this show. When suddenly when she has an orgasm, she turns into an 80-year-old woman. Whoa. Because she was an 80-year-old woman whose superpower she got from the storm was to be able to at will turn into a hot 20-something-year-old.
Wow.
Except when she gets very stressed or, you know, has an orgasm, she reverts back. Which comes as a bit of a surprise to the character underneath it.
Hi-o!
It's a terrific show. Well worth your time. And like I said, season 3 is great. And I'm so happy that we have an extra copy of this to, in fact, give out to you guys.
Awesome. And as you know from last week, we've changed our methodology a little bit. So it's no longer about who has the fastest finger. It's a creativity-based giveaway.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do is, in the comment section of this particular show, we're going to ask you to... Well, you know what, Chris? Why don't you explain to them what it is they're going to have to do?
Well, with this premise that I've explained it as it is, what I'd like to see from you guys, right, in the comment section, it doesn't have to be very long. In fact, it could be as long as you want it to be, just as long as we're talking about, like, a couple sentences at the bare minimum, is that imagine you're one of these guys. So tell us, what are you in for in the first place? What crime as a juvenile did you commit that got you there? What superpower did you end up getting from the storm? And what do you end up doing, based on what we know about you, with that superpower?
Boom. Why were you a juvenile? Why were you in juvenile detention hall in the first place? What superpower did you get from the storm? And what would you do with it? We're going to pick our favorite, and that person is going to win a copy of Misfits Season 3.
Absolutely.
It's like we're parents. We're going to pick our favorite son, and that one will get to go to college.
Exactly.
It's not that we don't love the rest of you. We just love the one who wins more.
Yes.
Yeah.
We want to make it a little more challenging than, oh, I happened to be on the site when the prompt was posted. So anyway, that's going to bring us to the end of another episode of Digital Noise. Just to remind you, you can find us on iTunes. You can search for us either One of Us or Digital Noise. In the podcast section. You can also use the RSS feed right there on the sidebar of the main page. You can follow us on Twitter, at DigiNoiseCast. That's D-I-G-I NoiseCast. Or you can follow us individually. I'm at BryGuySalisbury. Luke is at LD Mullen. Chris is at ChrisCoxCritic.
Chris Cox Critic. With K's.
No, not with K's.
Hi-o.
Don't spell it with K's.
Dude,
Jesus
I'm
Christ.
Totally awesome, like some metal band from the mid-90s.
Or the Ku Klux Klan.
You can also...
Hey! I love 42, sort of.
You can also follow the site on Facebook, facebook.com/oneofusnet. And please do make your next Amazon purchase through our site. Even if you aren't buying the item that we've linked to, if you know you're going to buy something from Amazon in the coming weeks, go ahead and click onto one of our links to get to Amazon and then buy whatever you want, because that does help support the site and we really do appreciate it.
Yup. But yep. I'm afraid it's time for us to go.
Oh no.
We're out of titles.
All right.
And we're sad to leave, but we do have some parting words for you.
Remember, it's a blue summer.